for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The leaders of 22 Arab states meeting in Egypt over the weekend agreed to form a joint military force. The accord comes as Saudi Arabia launches airstrikes in Yemen, a move widely perceived as an effort to thwart Iranian influence. Here to talk about risks related to the current regional power plays and the role of the U.S., Hisham Melham of Al Arabiya News Channel, Yoki Driessen of Foreign Policy, and Natan Gutman of Channel One Israeli News and the Jewish Daily Forward. Do join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Andy, it's good to see all of you.
Good to see you, Dan.
Good morning.
Thank you. Yoki Driessen, your piece in yesterday's Washington Post is titled Two Enemies, Seven Countries, One Conflict. Explain how the battle being fought in Yemen fits into the larger scene of utter chaos.
So there's been a Cold War and a shadow war raging in the Middle East, certainly since the invasion of Iraq and arguably decades before it, between Iran on the one hand wanting to be the sort of hegemonic force that could have control of Lebanon, of Iraq, pick the country, and Saudi Arabia on the other that felt like it's the guardian of certain parts of Islam, that it is wealthy, that it should be the sort of force pushing back. And it had been a Cold War for a very long time. You'd have proxies fighting each other in Iraq, proxies fighting each other in Egypt, in Lebanon, and now it's a hot war. Now you have the Saudi Arabian Air Force carrying out wave after wave after wave after wave of strikes. Bloggers and people with Twitter in Sana'a are saying it's carpet bombing, which seems exaggerated, but it's certainly intensive bombing. You have this talk of a ground force, and so far it's not working. What is striking to us, obviously sitting at some distance, is that the advances towards Aden, where the former and a kind of incredible Hollywood image of the former president getting onto a boat and sort of motoring away for fear the city was going to fall, the Houthis have not slowed. I mean, they are moving closer and closer to Aden. They still have full control of Sana'a. I mean, one sort of small tidbit that I think drives home just how insane this all is on some level. Someone asked me, well, how will the Saudis know where to bomb? And the answer is easy. They'll know where to bomb because they'll be bombing the Yemeni military bases they helped fund. I mean, they're bombing bases that were funded by the U.S. or by Saudi Arabia. They're bombing vehicles that were funded by the U.S. or by Saudi Arabia. So it's very easy for them to know where the stuff is because they paid for it to be built in the first place.
And Hisham Melham, give us the background on the Saudi airstrikes. When did they actually begin? And what is their ultimate objective?
The Saudis feel that they are defending their national security interests, their vital national security interests on the Arabian Peninsula. They look at Yemen or Bahrain the way we look at Mexico and the Caribbean. This is the place where they are mostly threatened. Yemen is the most populous country in the Arabian Peninsula. Yemeni-Saudi relationship have always been tense and very complex. In fact, in 2009, the Saudi Air Force conducted air raids and attacks against the Houthis in their redoubt in northern Yemen at that time. So there is a history of conflict between the Saudis and the Houthis, and Saudi involvement in Yemen has been historic, economic, political, and military. This conflict will continue for a long time, and the question that I asked after we heard the news about the bombing raids, the air attacks, I said, what follows the air campaign? The air campaign, at best, can slow the movement of the Houthis on the ground, but you cannot stop them on the ground unless you have a ground component. It's the same in Iraq. You cannot stop ISIS by just air raids and air campaign. You have to stop them on the ground by an air a land component. I don't see one anytime soon, and I don't believe this talk about forming a joint Arab force is the answer. There will be tremendous technical problems, logistical problems, command and control problems, the ability and the willingness to pay a price. One final point, Iran can fight its Arab enemies by using Arab tools Arab auxiliaries, as we've seen with Hezbollah and the Shia militias. No Sunni power in the region has that option. That's the dilemma of the Sunni powers, whether they are the Arabs or the Turks.
And turning to you, Natan, what about Iran's interest in that whole region and how much influence it has as opposed to the Saudis?
Well, it definitely does have influence. We should note that there is a real civil war going on even before regional powers try to turn it into a proxy war. The Houthis are trying to overturn the government in Sana'a, and they were successful in that. So definitely there is a real conflict going on. Now, with both sides stepping in, you have the Iranians trying to back the Houthis, support them militarily, financially, but without real troops and boots on the ground. And going back to the point that Hisham was making, the question is what happens next? I mean, will we see Saudi tanks or Egyptian tanks somehow rolling in? And if so, how will Iran respond to that? Are we going to go back to a Vietnam scenario? And in that sense, it doesn't seem as if there is any willingness from on behalf of either side right now to reach that point in which Saudi Arabia and Iran are actually fighting each other on the ground in Yemen.
But you've got proxies there for both Iran and Saudi Arabia, Yoki.
You have proxies, and you also have this very interesting historical parallel. You know, this is not the first time that Yemen has been bombed by Saudi Arabia. That goes back to 2009. It's not the first time that Egypt has talked about sending ground troops in. And the history there is fascinating. Gamal Abdel Nasser, you could argue a strong man, vaguely in the mold of Sisi, the current president, former military, secular, took power after a period of real chaos. He thought this would be a chance to have a pan-Arab force, that Egypt could be at the front of that force. He sent troops into Yemen. Egypt lost thousands of troops. There are people who refer to it as Egypt's Vietnam. They were there and they lost, and they pulled out. Saudi Arabia sent ground troops in 2009. Not many. They lost. At best, it was a stalemate. So none of this is new. And the idea of a ground force, I agree with Hisham, reasons to be skeptical. But if Egypt does it, they don't have a good history in Yemen. Their history is one of defeat.
So what are Saudi objectives in Yemen at this point?
To stop the Houthis from controlling the whole country, especially the southern part, which is still somewhat under the control of allies of President Hadi. So,
but with all these failures before, what's to say they're going to succeed now?
I don't see. I mean, there are no easy options for the Saudis and the Egyptians and the others. Especially that the Houthis have proved their resilience as good organized fighters. I mean, they've been on a roll, but I think they could stop them from reaching Aden. The most important southern city. I could see the possibility of the Egyptians and others sending troops there by sea or by air just to defend the city, but not to roll the tanks across the border. Yemen is an extremely mountainous, difficult country. I usually refer to it as the Arabs' Afghanistan, and they have a history. The Yemenis have a history of repelling foreign invaders. The Ottoman Empire did not occupy most of Yemen. It's just like you send an expeditionary force to Yemen. It's like sending an expeditionary force to Afghanistan. I mean, ask the Brits, ask the Russians. Mm. So that's why it is difficult. But the Saudis felt that they have to react because Iran is on a roll in Iraq, in Syria, and in Lebanon.
Natan.
Exactly. The Saudis look around them, and what they see is their regional nemesis or competitor, Iran, making gains in all of the other fronts. And they look to the north, and they see in Syria and Lebanon, of course, the fact that Iran is now a major player in Iraq and in a certain way even cooperates with the United States in Iraq. They look to Luzan, to the nuclear talks, and they see a possible maybe not a rapprochement, but a possible agreement that will ease the sanctions and save the Iranian economy. And now the South is going also towards the Iranians. So definitely the Saudis want to contain this this Iranian move in the Middle East. And even if they can't win over Yemen or reinstate President Hadi, at least they could somehow stop and contain.
Yoki, talk about the withdrawal of the 125 special ops forces from Yemen.
So you had what had been for a long time a very successful, frankly, counterterrorism program in Yemen that had troops on the ground that were carrying out direct action missions, which is to say raids. They were calling in drone strikes. Some of the initial drone strikes took place in Yemen, and as the number in Pakistan were falling, the number in Yemen were rising. The killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, was in Yemen. The killing of his son, also an American citizen, by a U.S. drone, was in Yemen. So you had a fairly active, and some of the WikiLeaks documents, the then president of Yemen said, it's okay if you do this, just let me say it was the Yemeni Air Force, wink, wink, nod, nod. And so it was a very open quid pro quo. The U.S. would bomb and the Yemeni president would say he had done it and everybody would be okay with it. And that's what had been taking place up until now.
Yoke Idris, and he's managing editor for News at Foreign Policy, author of the book The Invisible Front. Short break here. Your calls, your comments are always welcome. 800-433-8850.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. From Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
And welcome back. With the ongoing chaos in Yemen and other parts of the Middle East, here in this studio, Yoke Idris of Foreign Policy, Natan Gutman, he's Washington correspondent for Channel One Israeli News and the Jewish Daily Forward. Hisham Melhem is Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya News Channel. Here's an email which probably sums up a lot of people's feelings from Tony in Tamarack, Florida. He says, while I'm no fan of this administration's approach to the Middle East, it seems a side effect of our disengagement is that eventually nations in the region are taking ownership of their own security. I hope it ends well, but the potential is there for improvement over the current chaos. Would you agree, Yoki?
I think in an absolute best-case scenario, and if the Middle East has taught anything over the decades, it's that best-case scenarios very rarely happen. In an absolute best-case scenario, maybe, I think the much likelier path is that countries act in what they see as potentially short-sighted self-interest, and it makes things worse. You know, you could argue that an Israeli strike is a good thing. You could also argue an Israeli strike would be a catastrophe. You could argue that a Saudi nuclear program to counteract an Iranian one, or an Egyptian nuclear program, or a Turkish nuclear program are good things. You could also argue that each one of those is a potential catastrophe. You know, you had a Pax Americana that generally speaking, roughly speaking, kept the Middle East in some form of equilibrium. You didn't have open warfare between nations and what you'd had in other parts of the world or in the past. That's gone. So if you now have the Saudi Arabian move into Yemen alongside Egypt, potentially alongside other Arab countries, being the start of something, we haven't talked yet about what Iran can do in Yemen, whether Iran might decide to say, you're bombing Houthis. They could spin it as you're bombing civilians, so therefore we're going to protect civilians and have an excuse to fight back against Saudi Arabia in a very open way in Yemen, which you haven't seen in decades, if perhaps ever. So maybe best case scenario, but best case scenario seems so unlikely.
So how does what's happening in Yemen affect the negotiations going on currently between the U.S. and Iran?
I don't think there is a link, there is a direct link or causality here. I think the Americans always say, and I think, and I believe them, that the negotiations over the Iranian nuclear issue is not related or is not linked to Iran's or America's regional interests. Obviously, I mean, you cannot say that's total, absolutely separate, but in the end, a deal with Iran on the nuclear issue would stand or fall on its own, not because of what happens on the ground in Yemen or in Baghdad. I mean, but just briefly, Diane, we're paying today, all of us, the people of the region and the United States, for decade-long political dysfunction, economic and cultural stagnation, repressive governance. And now everything has exploded with the Arab uprisings 4 years ago. Iraq is a separate case because Iraq went to hell in 1980 when Saddam decided to invade Iran, and then one war led to another. That invasion led to the invasion of Kuwait. The invasion of Kuwait led to sanctions, and then the American invasion in 2003. So now, all of these things, we are paying now for the accumulation of all of these disasters, and all is falling down.
Back to the question I asked Hisham Natan, how do you believe the Iran negotiations with the U.S. are somehow affecting what's happening?
Well, clearly, formally, at least, the negotiators of the P5 plus one group sitting with the Iranians in Luzon right now are isolated from whatever is going on in Yemen. They're dealing with a nuclear issue. They want to get to a nuclear deal with Iran by tomorrow at midnight, and that's their goal right now. But when you look around, especially in terms of dealing with selling this deal, if you actually reach a deal, to the American public, then the situation in Yemen does play a role, because you're already hearing voices in Congress. We heard Speaker Boehner yesterday talking about how Iran is definitely and clearly and even more and in an even more highlighted way right now is a bad player in the region. And for President Obama to come now to Congress, to come to the Israelis, to come to public opinion and say, listen, I reached a deal with the Iranians, there are those who will use Yemen and will say, listen, these are the same Iranians who are messing up Yemen right now. How can you trust them for a deal?
Can't it be separated, Yogi?
I think the administration in its rhetoric can try to separate it. I don't think there's any chance that Congress, where skepticism about the deal is already high, frankly rising. There have been two concessions by the White House in recent days that have, frankly, many Democrats as well thinking you're desperate for dealings beginning
what
to show.
What were those concessions?
So the bigger of the two was allowing an underground facility called Fordo to continue to operate. The discovery of this facility a few years ago, just to give a sense of how much the world shook, was at the time a massive sign of the Iranians' continuing secret push towards a weapon. And now there's perhaps an admission that we will allow that facility to keep running. The scary thing is that facility was built to be largely impervious to bombs. So one fear is this continues to run. At some point, Iran boots out the inspectors. A facility that had been allowed to keep operating is impervious and can't be bombed. The other is this continuing question of number of centrifuges and quality of centrifuges. The U.S. has said for a long time it would be one number, roughly 19,000, then 10,000, which has been roughly where it's hovering. Then they said it would be a certain quality. Now they're saying that quality perhaps could be a little bit higher. And then on the Iranian side, for the Iranians for more than a year, we're saying they would be okay shipping out some of their uranium to Russia. Russia would convert it to a much lower quality uranium and send it back. But it would leave Iran And now they're saying they won't do that.
So now take us back to what's happening in Yemen and how what is happening there may, whether these negotiators are isolated or not, could find its way in.
I think that Congress, there's a very real chance that I don't think is fully appreciated sometimes even by those of us who are dorks living in D.C. who follow this, that Congress may kill the deal. Not try to kill the deal, but actually succeed in killing the deal. And the number of voices in Congress who are looking at Yemen saying Saudi Arabia is an ally, Saudi Arabia is being threatened by this same country that threatens our other ally, Israel, those voices are getting louder and louder and louder. And I think we really should not estimate that even if a deal comes together in the next day and a half, huge, unlikely, a huge, you know, 50-50, 60-40, we don't know the odds of it, it could be killed by Congress almost as soon as it's signed.
Yeah, sure.
No, I fully agree that the Congress will play a role, including the Democrats. Whether this is a formal treaty or not that, you know, by law requires the president to go to Congress, Congress will be playing a role. And I agree that when they look around and they see that if you give Iranians what they want the most now, which is sanction relief, that this relief will help Iran finance its regional ambitions. And that's the last thing many people in Congress, as well as America's allies in the region, want. This is the first time in decades you see the Arabs, the Turks, and the Israelis agree on one thing, and they are all loud here in Washington, you know, lobbying against a deal that would relieve Iran from sanctions. This is their most important thing at this stage.
So how much of a possibility is there for a real direct clash between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Well, that really depends on the situation on the ground. It could deteriorate quickly to a position in which there is no choice, but and both sides feel that they need to get involved directly. That seems unlikely because there doesn't seem to be that much motivation on either side to engage right now in direct combat against the other side. The Saudis stand little to gain from that. The Iranians would like to keep the conflict active, but they don't necessarily want to reach a boiling point there. So it seems to me at least that right now there isn't a great motivation to escalate that beyond the point that we've already reached.
So, following your comments, Hisham, one begins to wonder what role has the United States played in this chaos?
American policies have been tentative and reluctant and sometimes contradictory towards the whole region. We have a situation that was summed up beautifully by a friend of mine, a Kurdish leader in Iraq, who visited Washington recently. I asked him, what's happening on the ground? He laughed and he said, General Lloyd Austin, the commander of CENTCOM, is in charge of the air campaign against ISIS. The Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, is in charge of the land campaign against ISIS. That's one. The United States now supporting the Saudis and the other Arab coalition who are fighting the Houthis, who are being supported by the Iranians. The United States is not doing anything to the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who is being supported by the Iranians. One of the reasons we're not doing this is because we are concerned that the Iranians will hit us in Iraq, and they have, and General Allen even said that. Other officials say that. In many ways, we are being held hostage by the Iranians in Iraq. We cannot do certain things in Syria and other places. But let me go back to your earlier point. Yemen has never been that crucial for Iran's national security interests like Iraq or Syria or Lebanon. Yet, Iran has invested tremendous amount of money and energy in Iraq and in Syria and in Lebanon. Yemen is just the icing on the cake. The Iranians did not create the Houthi problem. The Iranians have been good at exploiting it, right? But they are not going to invest too much energy and resources in Yemen the way they will invest in Iraq. Iraq touches them directly as a national security interest. And it is in the interest of the Iranian state to have Iraq float in its own orbit. It's the interest of the Iranian state not to have Iraq extremely powerful again. And it's interest of Iran to have that outlet to the Mediterranean and to Lebanon to put pressure on the Israelis.
All right, and here's another email from David, who says, the Sunni and Shia and their respective controlled countries have been killing each other for nearly 1,400 years.
Not true.
No amount of U.S. military power will cure that relationship. It's about time these countries fight their own religious battles. The U.S. role is only if they expand beyond their borders. Let America be at the borders to stop them. Let the congressional warmongers fight each other and keep Obama's sane policies of no involvement. We are tired out of money to help rebuild American families and infrastructure.
Yeah, I suspect that David speaks for a huge swath of the listenership for this show and a huge swath of voters who say, even if they don't follow it, Iraq is a mess, Syria is a mess. Why are we as a country potentially losing more of our troops? Why are we spending, we've now spent more than $1 trillion, why should we spend more? I think that attitude is an attitude that is very common, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in the 2016 election. Do you have more of an isolationist tinge on the Republican Party and the Democratic Party as well? I would take issue with two things he said. Some of these countries had communities within the same border. I mean, borders have been fluid, but you had Shia communities and Sunni communities and Christian communities living in a rough sense, not necessarily peace, but they weren't slaughtering each other in the streets in Iraq for centuries, in Lebanon for centuries. It is not the case that you've just had continuing millennia of ongoing strife that just hasn't happened. There is, though, also a demographic issue. He mentioned, let's have just the U.S. on the borders. The problem is, and this comes back to Saudi Arabia, the oil-rich parts of Saudi Arabia, the people who live above those parts are Shia. So when this are Shiite. So when the Saudi Arabians look to Yemen, it isn't simply you have Iran pushing into Yemen and Yemen pushing close to their border. It's what of the Shiites who live in Saudi Arabia, who are impoverished, and they say, why don't we have some of this money?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Natan.
Well, I think the listener does touch on a very important issue that maybe the region is only starting to grasp right now. Maybe what we're seeing now in these latest Saudi moves is the beginning of a realization that there is a new philosophy in Washington, that this idea that you can be an ally and support the United States but expect America to fight your wars doesn't really play out that well in this with this current administration and following a decade of expensive and, frankly, not all that successful wars in the Middle East. So in that sense, this may be kind of a positive development of taking ownership.
Let's assume that the U.S. does not take any further steps and stays out of this. What do you see as a possible outcome with the mess going on in Yemen?
I think in Yemen and other places, unfortunately, these conflicts, these civil wars, these state wars. Now we have proxy wars, we have civil wars, and we have foreign legionnaires and all sorts of craziness, if you will. This is going to run its course and it's going to take a long time. I fully agree. The United States cannot save the Muslims and the Arabs from themselves. The United States cannot save or stop the Sunni-Shia onslaught. But the United States did contribute to the Sunni-Shia onslaught because of the invasion and because of the wars.
Okay, but where is it going? Is it going to stay there?
I mean, the last place you saw in the Middle East where the U.S. sat it out and allowed other countries to take the lead was Libya. And if you look at any country that's even more of a mess than Yemen with less of a future, that seems likely to be a mess with less of a future for decades to come, it's Libya. So we may not want to be there, and there may not be much we can do even if we are there. But at some point, let me take a step back very briefly. The terror group that's considered to be the most dangerous terrorist group in the world is not the Islamic State. It's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen. They're the one that have come the closest to downing American planes. The underwear bomber.
The shoe bomber.
Yeah, 2009, yes.
The underwear bomber on Christmas Day, almost bringing down a plane over Detroit. They almost brought down cargo planes over my beloved hometown of Chicago. They have come close. They're thought to have a bomb maker whose last name is Asiri, who has built bombs out of things other than metal. You have U.S. officials openly saying that he has liquid bombs, plastic bombs, bombs that can't be detected. They're the al-Qaeda group considered to be the most dangerous one on the planet. So let's look ahead a month, 2 months, and there's, God forbid, an American plane is taken down somewhere in the world, and it traces back to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and it traces back to Yemen. The pressure in the U.S. to do something is going to be irresistible. The U.S. will have to get in, whether it can do anything, whether it should do anything. There won't be any other choice.
Yoki Driessen, managing editor for News at Foreign Policy. Short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom-framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. From PwC, the right people to get the extraordinary done. Learn more at pwc.com/extraordinary. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, advances in technology mean widespread access to potentially dangerous tools that could be used to attack people and states. To law and security experts on the future of violence and why government should rethink how to protect their citizens. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Phones and headphones for all. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Bob in Louisville, Kentucky. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. It's an honor to be on the program, Diane.
Thank you, Bob. Go right ahead.
First, before I get to my comment, I want to just say just for a second, there are an awful lot of people who are Syrian in Syria who support that government, not just Iran, Christians. Even a good number of Sunnis support that government. So, but saying that, that's a whole other discussion for another day. I don't see Iran. I don't see Hezbollah or Assad going around and crucifying Christians. But I do see ISIS. I do see al-Qaeda. And I do see the Saudi government, which is probably the most oppressive government on the planet, where women can't even drive, where Christians are beheaded, and is even more oppressive religiously than Iran, and much further away from democracy than Iran. Here's my point. Not that we should be taking any side, but would you think I'm out of line, just as an American citizen, for believing that the Sunni side of this ledger is by far, much more disturbing than what I'm seeing from the Shia? I'm just speaking as an American.
What do you think, Natan?
Well,
My guess is that Americans, you probably don't want to get into the discussion of who's better and who's worse, whether the Sunnis or the Shias. America has a pretty good relationship with the Saudis that's based not on shared values and not on any sense of supporting their human rights record or their lack of democracy there, but just on practical and geostrategic moves on the ground. And that's why Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States, not because America endorses the Sunni perspective of Islam rather than the Shia one, just because this is where your allies are right now.
All right, to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Mehdi, you're on the air.
Dan, thank you very much. I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
Yes, there is, of course, a Cold War between Saudi Arabia and Iran. There is, of course, the reflection of that is a Shia-Sunni drift in recent, of course, years that did not, of course, exist to this extent. But let us not forget that this is the second country that Saudi Arabia is bombing and invading. The first one, of course, and invaded was Bahrain. And we do not know to what extent the Iranian interest is in Bahrain, I'm sorry, in Yemen at the moment. But when we go back, of course, to Bahrain, we know it. Iranian did not have any influence whatsoever in Bahrain. And a majority Shia in Bahrain is suppressed by the tanks of the Saudi and the invasion over there.
Yoki.
He's right on that last point, that there were Saudi tanks sent in. The first point about Saudi bombing in Bahrain, not true to the knowledge of anybody, I think, who's reported it in terms of Saudi airstrikes. But he gets at something very important, which is that there are Shiite communities in all of the Gulf monarchies. The one in Saudi Arabia, again, is both very large and on top of the Saudi oil field. So for Saudi Arabia, for Bahrain, there is a domestic element to this as well. They feel like Iran would love to topple them from the outside. They feel like they are repressing Shiites who would love to topple them from the inside, and they're very precariously balanced between the two.
Here's an email from Kurt in Byron, Illinois. What happens if the Shiites in Saudi Arabia start to revolt now that the Saudi Sunnis are bombing the Yemen Shiites?
If we're talking about serious uprising, of course, this will be extremely dangerous for the stability of Saudi Arabia. So far, we haven't seen that, although we've seen in the past the local Shia expressing their unhappiness by a variety of things. These people believe that they are not getting their they are not empowered. They are not getting the benefits that other people get. That they believe that there is discrimination against them. I think in recent years the Saudi government is trying to address them because they are very concerned about this community being influenced by the Iranians. I have to say about Kuwait, I mean about the Bahrain and even Yemen. The Saudis did not create the problem in Bahrain. There is a majority of Shia in Bahrain, and they have been agitating for legitimately and peacefully in many cases for their full rights. And I think Iran did not create that, but Iran exploited that. And just as Iran did not create the Houthi problem in Yemen, but Iran is exploiting it.
To Pontiac, Michigan, Clark, you're on the air.
For the panel, which would the Saudis prefer? An Iran that has a nuclear weapon but has a economy in shambles because of the restraints, or an Iran with a economy booming but no nuclear weapon?
Yoki.
It's a great question and really a fascinating one. My suspicion is the latter, because they wouldn't see the latter as an existential threat potentially to them in the region. But it's a really, really interesting question. Saudi Arabia, other Gulf countries have in the past traded with Iran. They've had business ties to them. It hasn't been something, even now, the UAE, even now, the United Arab Emirates, had until recently a flourishing trade with Iran. So even in the midst of all the nuclear fears, they were still intertwined economically. My strong suspicion is no nuclear bomb, booming economy would be the choice they would want.
The nuclear bomb is a game changer in many senses. It would necessarily drive the Saudi Arabian leadership to seek its own nuclear bomb. it would start a nuclear arms race in the region. And of course, it would provide Iran with this umbrella of protection against any kind of attempt to limit its power. So I think regional other regional players are very fearful of the scenario of Iran getting a nuclear weapon, even if it means weakening their economy in a very significant way.
Hisham.
The Saudis have been chafing because they are living in the shadow of Iran's conventional military power and its ability to project power or to use Arab proxies. The last thing they want is a nuclear-armed Iran. If the Iranians embark on rebuilding their economy, I think the Saudis will probably be happy and maybe play a role in that. Iran has serious economic problems. Iran has a large demographic, youth. There's a youth bulge there, and they want their rights. They want to be empowered. They want to enjoy life in the modern age. It will take Iran a long time to recover its health economically. So I don't think the Saudis will see that as a threat, but definitely a nuclear-armed Iran is a huge threat to them.
All right. To Jim in Lake St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air.
How you doing, ma'am?
Good.
Yes, ma'am. I worked in Yemen for 2 years at the American Embassy. They're great people. However, you know, I was there during the Saleem, the president, civil war that was when he was taken over and kicked out. But most people don't realize also that Yemen has another problem, a very bad problem, and this is what they call addiction to a drug. And the drug is GOT. And GOT is actually a kind of like a bush. It has leaves, which they take off. And it's not just male, it's both male and female. And this is, you know, this is also affecting Yemen's ability to progress, is what I feel, having been there for 2 years.
What do you think, Hisham?
No, I mean, I agree. Qat is Yemen's curse, in my opinion. And Qat is the plant that is taking all the water in Yemen. And Yemen has a serious problem of water. I mean, Yemen will probably be the only country in the world where there would be no drinkable water. And Yemen is poor enough, unlike its neighbors in the Arabian Peninsula, who can build plants to desalinate the ocean's water. So Yemen is in serious trouble, in part because of this. And the Qat, which is addictive, it's a national, everybody chews Qat, if you will. And
what is it?
It's a downer.
It's a downer.
Yes, exactly. And it affects productivity. You cannot have a modern humming economy when practically everybody enjoys this thing in the afternoon. And, I see warriors going to the front with their cheeks bulging, with Qat because they're chewing it. I mean, this is a problem. They tried to stop it in the past, especially in the South, when the South was under leftist control. They failed. It's a serious problem that requires a serious attention. It's an economic problem. It's a social problem.
Nadan.
And, of course, it's not the only problem that Yemen faces. It is the poorest country in the region. It has no natural resources to speak of. And it is undergoing years of internal strife. So all these taken together definitely put Yemen in a very poor position to start this whole discussion. They have very few strategic assets. They control the straits of the Red Sea. Obviously, they have now a lot of interest from the Saudis and the Iranians, but they don't have that much going for them right now.
So if they don't have that much going for them, where does this go?
Well, that depends on the regional powers, how far they want to take their involvement in this. Do they want to escalate the situation or not? I'm guessing they don't really want to escalate it that much. And I don't think anyone in the region would mind leaving Yemen as a failed state, as terrible as that may sound, as long as America keeps its interests.
What does that mean if Yemen becomes a failed state or stays as a failed state?
Right. I think your last point nailed it.
Right.
I think it'd be optimistic to say it would become one. It would mean a country that has no functioning civil government, that has no military capable of policing its own borders, no security forces capable of preventing terror groups like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula from having bases from which to operate very freely. It would mean a country that had a functioning economy. These are all things Yemen doesn't have and hasn't had in a long time. But when we say failed state, we say modern Yemen. We say impoverished. We say civil war. We say foreign countries can swoop in and do what they want. We say a country that has no economy, a drug-addicted populace, terror groups that operate freely and at will in much of the country, and that is modern Yemen.
Terror groups and refugee problem. If things get worse in Yemen, you will have a serious refugee problem. This will affect Saudi Arabia directly. This will affect the neighboring countries directly. I mean, just look back at Afghanistan. You know, we packed up and left after we defeated the Soviet Union, and look what happened. A chaotic situation in which the neighboring countries, in that case, Pakistan mainly, exploited the situation. We ended up with the Taliban, and the rest is history, and you know it. That's why Yemen is important in that sense. And I think the Obama administration was correct in taking on al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, because that's the most lethal group against the United States. If you have a chaotic situation, maybe ISIS will have established its bases there. We've seen what's happening with al-Shabaab in Somalia. These are failed states, but the problems of these failed states never remain within the borders of those failed states. This is the modern age. This is, you know, terrorism in the globalized world. And you cannot expect the Yemenis to maintain their problems and suffer alone without affecting the neighborhood, and by affecting the neighborhood, probably affect the rest of the world.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And that is takes me right into the question of, do you expect all this chaos in the Middle East to lead to further aggression against the United States, Yogi?
Yes. I think that, you know, Islamic State is talked about continually. But when you think about the Islamic State, inherent in the fact that it thinks of itself as a state is that it wants to control territory. I'm not sure that they actually would, at this point, want to export attacks outside their borders. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula would love to. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa would love to. And part of it, frankly, is just marketing. Islamic State right now is the cool brand for, I don't mean to be glib, but if you're a young jihadist, you want to go fight for the Islamic State. You don't want to necessarily go fight for Al-Qaeda. The best way, if you are Al-Qaeda, that you want to assert we are still relevant, we're still a good way of striking the United States, of causing pain to the United States, is to help bring down an American plane. It's to help carry out a massacre in an American mall or hotel. Al-Qaeda has an incentive to do it alongside a willingness to do it, a demonstrated capability of doing it, and the resources to do it. And I think that's the real threat.
And don't forget, when we hit Syria, first time, we hit the Khorasan group. These are people who are planning to attack the United States, according to U.S. Intelligence services. So, but even if you allow this chaos unchecked, it will affect the interest of our allies in the region. I mean, take Syria, for instance. The five states around Syria, four of them have had tremendous friendly relationship with the United States: Turkey, a NATO power, Israel, Jordan, and Lebanon. And in the last 12 years, we invested tremendously in Iraq. So it's not in the interest of the United States to see any of these states to fall. And Lebanon and Jordan probably will fall because of the pressure of refugees and economic problems because of the Syrian conflict.
What can we expect the U.S. to do at this point?
Well, there are no good options, as is the case many times in the Middle East. The best option would be to try and figure out a strategy that would contain the situation in Yemen in order to keep the main and probably only American goal there, which is to keep AQAP in check, to make sure.
And what would that strategy entail?
It could be somehow maintaining the current situation, which would allow counterterrorism activity on behalf of the U.S. even with less cooperation.
But these 125 special ops forces have already left.
Right. So you'd have to restore that somehow and get some kind of cooperation with minimal military activity on the ground.
Do you expect that to happen?
That's a tall order.
No, and I think the best case scenario, and frankly the smartest one, would be Saudi Arabia to invest money, actual money, to try to build up some infrastructure, try to build up roads, try to say to the Houthi, you have a future. The Houthi have in the recent past, said that they don't want to govern, that they would like to be in coalition. Whether you take that seriously or not, there's at least a small glimmer that if you offer true incentives, true carrots, and you say, rather than bombing you, we will build you roads, we will build you universities,
this is
they are spending tens of billions of dollars Sounds the Saudis
good
are.
To me.
They're spending tens of billions right now in Egypt, tens of billions combined in Lebanon and Jordan. It is doable. Whether they want to or not, it is doable.
The problem is that you have a governance problem. Most of that money sometimes goes to corrupted officials and institutions. You don't have really viable institutions. You cannot do this in Yemen unless you settle the governance problem first. That's, Yoki is correct, but only in the long term. Immediately, we have a problem. And I think there is a political component. The president of the United States should be involved with the Turks, with the Saudis, with the Omanis, with everybody, and to come up with that strategy that allows us to use the services and the help of these neighboring countries. Otherwise, without their help, we're not going to do it.
Hisham Belham, Yoki Driessen, Natan Gutman. Thank you all. I must say, it is not an outlook that promises happiness
in the near term.
Unfortunately.
Let's hope for the best. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.